Welcome to Orchard Conversations, a podcast brought to you by the Orchard community.
And I think any creative process, right? And in our culture, we have these pretty limited beliefs around time sometimes. And so what I would encourage people is like, whatever creative process, recognize that it is a process and that there's a part of slowing down in life and in writing that allows us to process in a different way. For the person listening out there, you know, find your art, your form, what works for you, what flows out of you really naturally. It shouldn't be something that feels really hard. It should be something that, yes, it takes sometimes slowing down. It's a process. And it should be something that feels pretty natural to you, whatever that is.
Hey, what's up, friends? I'm Scott Hodge, lead pastor of the Orchard Community. So good to have you with us for our digital liturgy today. Man, what an inspiring summer it has been for us as a community. If you've been with us, you'll know that we've been in a series called Here to Create. And we've been having some insightful and, well, empowering and, yes, even challenging conversations with some pretty amazing people and friends. And so I want to mention real quick, if you've missed any of these conversations, I want to encourage you to go back and catch up. I'm telling you, I mean, this would be a great weekend to do that. Go to orchardconversations.com, or you can go to your favorite podcast app and look us up and not only get caught up, but subscribe to our podcast so you can stay on top of these great conversations that are coming up in the next few weeks. Well, listen, today we are thrilled to welcome Joy Thomas and Janelle Landgraf to our digital liturgy. Many of you might probably know Joy Thomas. Joy is better half. I'm not sure if we're allowed to say things like that anymore, but Joy is the amazing partner and wife to Benjamin J. Thomas. And Janelle Landgraf, you'll get to meet here in just a moment. Joy and Janelle are identical twins who are living with a condition called retinitis pigmentosa, which is a progressive eye disease, and one that they kind of kept under wraps for quite some time, until about a decade ago when they sort of broke their silence through their blog called doublevisionblog.com. Definitely one you're going to want to check out. But the goal of this was really to help shatter this notion that there is a quote-unquote correct way to go blind. And I'll tell you, since that time, their digital platform, along with just the work they do, their careers, have been a beacon of inspiration to those in the disabled community and even far beyond it. And so we're thrilled today to have Joy and Janelle with us for what is going to be a candid and very inspiring conversation. And so I want to encourage you to open your hearts as we dive into today's conversation. All right. Hey, we're here with Joy and Janelle. It's so good to have you guys with us today. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Absolutely. Well, I feel like if we don't dive right in, we have so much we could talk. We could talk for probably 2 hours, but we won't do that. I would love, though, to start by talking a little bit about, I guess, hearing about both of your journeys, even like going back maybe to your early diagnosis of RP to where you're at today. And then can you kind of tell us about RP? What is RP? Retinitis, right? Retinitis pigmentosa?
Yes.
Did I get it?
Yeah.
So all right.
Janelle came into the world 4 minutes sooner. I'll let you start. Yes, I'm the oldest by 4 minutes. And I held that over her head until recently. Well, now she brags that she's younger. So retinitis pigmentosa is a very long name, kind of confusing sounding, just that describes a group of degenerative eye conditions. So it's going to look different depending on the person. But essentially, when we were young, our parents noticed that we would suddenly be a little bit more shy and clumsy in the dark, and took us to an ophthalmologist and were first diagnosed with night blindness. And then upon further testing, realized that we had some peripheral vision loss that would slowly deteriorate over time. And so When we were young, we had already lost a pretty significant amount of peripheral vision, but had our central vision intact. And just so I like to explain it, people explain it different ways. For me, it makes the most sense to explain it like you're looking at a puzzle. And this is how I see it. I don't know if Joy wants to, I'll let her describe differently, but sure. It's like the edges of the puzzle have been put together, kind of like the center has been put together. And then there's like a lot of pieces missing around, typically like a lot of the pieces are missing, like a big donut hole around the central vision. Mm-hmm. And so growing up, it was a lot that we could see. I mean, we could do print. For all intents and purposes, it really seemed like we had normal vision for the most part. And then over time, it has been something that has declined quite a bit, especially in the last couple of years.
Yeah.
So say that how old were you guys? Like when you found out or when you were diagnosed, I know you said you were first diagnosed with, what was it?
Five. We were 5 years old. Yeah.
5 years old.
And, wow. Yeah. And okay. We kind of have vague memories of like, they had like a doctor with like Big Bird on his finger, follow Big Bird, like, you know, and just kind of talking about it, but not really, you know, knowing a lot about it. I mean, you're a kid, right? Mm-hmm. So you don't
Right.
You're kind of picking up things here and there.
You're like thinking about playing outside and doing fun things at five. You're not like, right?
Right. But then there would be these weird moments where like, I remember like running across a friend's yard to go play with her and not seeing like a giant bike. That's one of the quotes about RP. It's like seeing a little piece of paper across the room and tripping over an elephant on the way to get there. That's like, makes so much sense. And I remember just plowing over this giant bike and it hurt so bad. But more than that, I remember the friend's parents looking at me. And I remember that like, just my face like flaming red with embarrassment because it was just like, wait, how did she just run over that bike? I remember I was probably like 8 or 9 and I just felt like, oh, this is not good. Wow.
Let's dive into that just a little bit more. When you guys were kids, I mean, what was that like? Did you talk about it at like as a family? Was it like on the forefront of your conversations? And how did that, you know, whether it was or not, how did that shape, would you say, like your childhood and maybe even your relationship with each other?
In my recollection, it was not something that we talked about. We had a yearly eye appointment that was like kind of a big deal because we lived in the suburbs of Chicago. And so we would go into the city and it was like, oh, going into the city. And we typically, our parents would try to make something fun about
it. Go to Ed DeBevick.
Yeah. Yeah.
Something fun
about
go get yelled at. Before
go get yelled at and go get all the eye drops and all the time. I mean, it was a whole day of testing that was just not torture, but not pleasant, you know, getting your eyes dilated and having a lot of different physicians at the University of Chicago, where it's a teaching school. So a lot of different people looking at your eyes, doing different tests and feeling like you're getting it all wrong because you can't see all the things you know that you're supposed to be seeing. Mm. So it wasn't something that I recall talking about. It just felt like it was kind of like in the background.
Normal part of life or something.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe a normal part of life. And I think, you know, losing vision is not like it's not something even like diabetes that's a little bit more common that people have heard of. And so it's not something where like, oh yeah, the neighbor down the street has RP too, or that like it was something that was just so out there that it really didn't make sense to us. And I don't think it made sense to our parents. I definitely can't speak to them. I mean, they were raising four kids and it was the 80s. There was no Google.
So, yeah, you're not online.
Yeah. You can't. Different time.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Totally. I mean, it was like the only exposure that most people probably had to something like this is like the caricatures or something you see on TV or, you know, I picture like what was that guy? Mr. Magoo, right? It was like, I mean, it's interesting, like how this portrayal of blindness in media, right?
And how pretty negative. Yeah.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, And so, you know, I'm curious, what was there an age where this really became like where this really started becoming a problem for you guys individually, and where you're like, we almost like maybe in denial or pretending this wasn't really happening or hiding it, or like, how did this affect you guys as you got older, maybe even as teenagers or young adults?
Yeah, I can't recall like a specific age, but I do know, yeah, as we were becoming teenagers, of course, you know, what's the in Western culture in the United States, you know, a rite of passage is getting your driver's license. So that was a big deal, not getting our driver's license. I thought we might be able to. My mom says she remembers the doctor clearly saying no, but in my mind it was like, oh, it's questionable. And so even at the DMV, they test your central vision, which I passed. And then they had just these blinking things on the side. And I passed that too, because it's just, they're not testing for every blind spot. But yeah. But when I took driver's ed, it was pretty clear I was missing a lot. But yeah, so I think that was definitely, and it was not something, yeah, I wanted my friends to know, maybe close friends, but other than that, it was like kind of, you know, it felt embarrassing or maybe even shameful, just because it was, again, you see these portrayals on TV or in movies. A Christmas Story is one even where like Ralphie, like, you'll shoot your eye out, and they have this image of him. Blind person looking, you know, and I don't know. It's just, different.
Very pitiful images of blindness. And I even remember like in fifth grade being out on the playground and like telling my best friend, like, oh, I have this eye condition. And she didn't believe me. Like, she started laughing. She's like, no, you don't. You know, it was one of these things like, she wasn't trying to be mean. I think she just thought I was being goofy, or it didn't make sense to her because she clearly saw that I could read books in school. I could, I wasn't using any special adaptive tools at that time. And yet in PE class, I could never hit the ball. But the assumption, I think, was just like, she's bad at sports. And it was just, or as we got older, what an airhead. Oh, she's kind of ditzy. Like, it was, people would make up stories around what we were like, or what I was
or
like.
Rude or stuck up. Like, oh, we wave to the hall, but you never say hi. You never wave to us. And you never just like, you feel kind of like, you want to explain, but at the same time, it doesn't make sense to people because, again, this narrative is either blind sighted. There's not really an in between. I mean, people are starting to a little bit more now with more stories being out there, but
They have no frame of reference. Like, like someone can be partially sighted or partially blind. That doesn't make sense to most people, or at least it didn't back then.
Well, and I think especially for a child, I think like we have this idea sort of culturally that like, oh yeah, as you get older, your vision might deteriorate. But for a little girl, like that's a lot to carry. Like you had a burden that you were carrying and you were so young. And that's a lot. That's a lot. That's all I have to say about that. Thank you for sharing.
So let's fast forward a little bit. Janelle, you're a therapist. Joy, you're an educator. And you both work in the mental health field specifically, right? So I'm curious, like, how do you feel like your personal experiences, what you went through, led you or guided you into the roles? Is it connected? Do you feel like? Is it like, absolutely, we know it's connected? Or is it like, we probably would have done this no matter what? This is just kind of who we, you know. I don't know. What do you think about that?
In my mind, it's 100% connected.
Same. Yeah. I think even just the compassion and empathy that you gain when you struggle yourself, it's like you have a certain knowledge that, this is what it feels like. I mean, very human. Of course, we've all felt what it's like to feel left out or lonely or less than or incompetent or whatever, all the things. But like when you kind of have these like heightened experiences of it, and when it's like this stark contrast to like, when I go into this one mode and I've run into this thing, this is how I feel, or this is how I'm perceived. And then you can kind of step back in and out of it. And so it did definitely foster this compassion and then, you know, desire to help other people who are experiencing similar things.
I feel like it would be,
I mean, going through, and especially going, you know, in those years where we're being so formed by the experiences and you know, in school and in friendships and these things, it sounds like there were so many assumptions made about you guys. And, you know, how did that not shut you down? Like, how did that not, because you guys have gone on to not just become very successful in your careers, but you guys have gone on to, and we'll talk in a minute about your writing and speaking and interviewing and things you've been able to do all these years later that are impacting people's lives. Probably in ways, I'm guessing, like in ways you would have not even imagined when you were, you know, 15, 16 years old, right? But I'm curious, like, what kept you from just shutting down and hiding from everyone? Because I feel like, you know, I'm naturally an introvert. People don't really think that about me, but it would be easy for me, I think, to like, and it, sometimes it is, to like sort of withdraw and just kind of get into a, I don't know, a vacuum, so to speak, when I'm creating or when I'm doing my work. And that's not good for me, you know? But I'm curious, like, how did that, like, what was it that helped you guys not do that? Or are you just so naturally, like, energized by life and it just, like, was not even a challenge for you?
I mean, I guess I'm floored by this question even, because I feel like we did shut down. Like, I mean, not we did come out of it, but we really did not talk about the loss we were experiencing, really not even to each other. It was just kind of this, felt like this taboo topic that even with our partners, we both met our husbands really young in high school and both got married in our early 20s. I remember talking to Tori about it. I think you remember talking to Ben, but it wasn't like this major topic of conversation. It was kind of like, I mean, kind of like how when you're young and you just don't spend any time talking about aging, right? Like, you're like, well, yeah, that's right, for future me to world. You know, it's totally. Like, it didn't feel real relevant. So it really, I don't think it was until we had started having children and when we're in our early 30s where it became like, wow, this is something that it really has an impact and has had an impact on our life for a long time that we've
missing.
Out of shame. And I'll let Joy share her.
Yeah, I mean, gosh, I'm even thinking like my teaching job, I essentially left because I could not muster the courage to tell my principal about some things that were happening with, ironically, the special education teachers were the worst, not wanting to place their kids in my class, not wanting to that was when I was trying to be upfront about my vision and just some things that happened. You know, conferences where I didn't see a family and they went to the dean and said that I ignored them, just like things like that, that I was just devastated and was like, oh my gosh, that's like to be like misperceived and to have somebody think that you're one way when you're like, oh my gosh, no, I would never, you know, I actually wanted to talk to that family so badly. And so, I mean, I think that shutting down cost me some things, but then also, you know, some of it's societal. Like there was a job that when I first started teaching that they didn't hire me, and I had found out from the teacher who had talked to the principal who didn't give me the job that it was because he said I wasn't making eye contact, even though he knew about my eye condition. So I mean, things like that where it's like, okay, there's some self shutting down, but then there's some like shutting out by society. And you know, it was painful. So it wasn't something that we really wanted to talk about until it was until it was time to start talking about it. So
well, let's talk about that. Oh yeah, go ahead, Janelle. What were you gonna say?
I was just gonna say, I want to add, like, even hearing Anna when you were like so compassionate and validating about how difficult our experience was growing up, and it kind of almost makes me emotional to talk about.
Yeah, same.
We came from very loving and caring families. And at the same time, the message, whether or not this was really happening, but the message we felt like, or I feel like we received, was really like, well, why would you be embarrassed about that? So, why don't they just come? Like, it just felt like
we were the ones doing something wrong. Like, if we would just stop worrying about it, it's just not that big of a deal.
If you tell people, and it just, it felt like, whether this was intentional or not, felt very dismissive of just how difficult the experience was.
Yeah,
and so to be able to talk about that later on has been really empowering, but it definitely felt like it was kind of perceived as like a personal flaw that like we just needed to be better about. And I get that. I do think that there's some truth in like in coming out and being honest and vulnerable about our abilities. And at the same time, like Joy was talking about, there's a lot of stigmatization and stereotypes that are really real. And to not name those is really disempowering.
Right.
I feel a little bit like, and this is maybe especially true for a female body, but there's a little bit of like a rock and a hard place where it's like we're on one hand encouraged to be vulnerable and to share all of our struggles with our bodies, whether they're, you know, like serious disability or mental illness or just, you know, like whatever, cramps, we'll go there, sorry Scott, but like, and then on the other hand we're taught to minimize that and feel this, like the word shame has come up a couple times here. Like we're taught to like, and I don't think this is exclusively true for women, for female bodies, but I think we bear the brunt. But to have that push and that pull of like, you should be ashamed that you're not perfect, but also you should be loud and proud about that you're not perfect. And it's like, it's like the Barbie movie, you know, it's literally impossible to be a woman. It's so hard. Go ahead.
I just want to add, like, we're like, our experience like of vision loss and disability too, like I'm like a cisgender Caucasian middle class female, right. Like my experience, I just like feel like it's important to add, is we going to be in the
a certain amount of privilege in that we live in smaller bodies, we have like just all of that. High school and things like that were easier because of that, even compared to some people that we talk with the same condition who, you know, have different experiences. So I'm glad you're acknowledging that too.
So what was the shift? I mean, I'm sure it wasn't like, you know, you woke up one day and were like, we have a voice here that we need to, you know, but what was it? Because you said, you know, you're talking about your experience until you guys had that or that time or that season or whatever it was that you were like, we need to, well, do what? Like, embrace this? Is that what you did? Like, what shifted for you guys? How did that happen?
I don't know if it was like a conscious, like, okay, yes, we woke up one day and like, let's shift and we're going to be empowered, you know, kind of thing. But Janelle did have the idea to start writing a blog. And it was like back in 2010 or 2009, back when blogging was kind
of... For those of you who don't know what blogging is, it's it's not, you know...
I love blogs. I don't know why we keep talking about how blogs are dead. I feel like we need to like have a blog renaissance because they're great.
Blog revival.
I had one. Yeah, I had three or four actually. Yeah.
Yes, you had a great blog. Yeah, and I guess now it's becoming more vlogs or podcasts or whatever.
Yeah,
People like to listen to things, and but
here we are.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. So she had that idea and we started writing and quickly found that our friends and family really were like, oh my gosh, we've always wanted to know this. We've always wanted to know some of these things. And, you know, we have our avid readers, like my Uncle Kevin, who's like always like, it's just so human. I relate on so many levels, you know, just it's super sweet. And then it's been fun because we've had people then with our same condition or family members with the same condition or just vision loss in general who have really, you know,
said, gosh, you put words to this experience that I was having that I couldn't name. And that meant so much to me. And that's huge. So,
and that people are able to share it with their family members and be like, hey, this is what my experience or similar to my experience of going blind. Yeah. And that's been a neat way for us to connect too with people within the blind and low vision communities. I mean, some of our closest friends, I don't feel like we would have met if it weren't for our blog that connected us to other people who have connected us to other people. And this amazing woman, Becky Andrews, who started Daring Sisters, which is a group that runs retreats and kind of support circles for women who are blind and losing vision.
And now men too.
And men too.
So, so it seems like this, your blog is a great example. I feel like well, first of all, you say, I think it's, I don't know where I read this. Maybe it's on your blog where it says like the goal of this is to show that there's no wrong way to go blind. That's powerful. That's like,
no, right,
I almost feel like that could be used with anything. There is no wrong way to fill in the blank. But can you expound on that for a minute? I mean, I think you kind of already have in some ways, but like expound on that a little bit. Like what are the ways, do people have these ways they think they should go blind, or they have these preconceived ideas of this is what it's going to look like, or this is going to be these are going to be my struggles. And then suddenly life happens and it's different than they thought, or they can't. I'm sitting here trying to answer the question that I just asked. Sorry.
Yeah, no, well, as Mel said earlier, a lot of people, you know, were encouraging us, oh, if you could, you know, just do this, just do that, just tell people, or just, and I guess use a cane would be one of them. Yeah. I ended up winning a scholarship when I was going to grad school from the National Federation of the Blind, and got infusion into the blind community, going to this conference where I won the scholarship and everybody had canes or dogs. And they were like, you know, if you're not, what was it? One of the things they're amazing advocacy group, but they're very staunch. They're very strong in their beliefs. And so it was like, if you are, you know, going out without your cane, you are being an imposter of sighted people. You are not sighted and you are lying to the world, you know, that kind of thing. And oh my gosh. Wow. So then all of a sudden I felt like, kind of shame the other way. Like I should have my cane out, like loud and proud and just feeling like, you know, but I also like met amazing people at that organization who were like getting around so well, and attorneys and, you know, judges and just really incredible, accomplished people who, had amazing blindness skills. And so that was kind of my door into that world. And at the same time, I had all these experiences. And then Janelle, you can kind of take from there, where I was kind of moving 100 miles an hour with these things. And she was kind of like, wait a second, I'm not ready for all that.
Yeah, that's why, like, as identical twin sisters, we've been in really different places with how we're adjusting to blindness, with her getting a guide dog. I chose not to get a guide dog. I did go to some cane training, chose not to use my cane as early as she did. Just kind of being in different places and experiencing some shame and self-judgment related to that. And then fast forward all these years, you know, now as part of my private practice as a clinical social worker, I have a contract with Washington State where I provide adjustment to vision loss counseling to a variety of people who have lost vision from, you know, anything from diseases similar to ours to domestic violence, accidents, just a wide range of people adjusting to vision loss. And it's been really fascinating and so incredibly validating for me to bear witness and walk alongside these individuals who are all adjusting in their own way. And I really try my best as like a healing presence to come alongside with compassion and non-judgment and encouragement to learn the blindness skills and to adapt and find some what we call in the psychology world like
radical acceptance. Like, doesn't mean you have to like it, but like having this practice of like, I'm going to choose to make something meaningful and find new meaning and shift what I think meaning is in my life. And lots of times people's family members or friends who can be really well-meaning have this idea of what their family member should or shouldn't be doing, from don't you dare get that cane out, that's embarrassing, to oh, you really should know Braille already. Like, there's a lot of expectations, and that just, it really adds to the shame and really can be just such a complicated process of adjusting to vision loss. So it's been very eye-opening to me and validating and normalizing.
Can I ask, what are some things that have really brought you, that concept of shame keeps coming up, and I'm wondering, like, what are some things, if you could share, that have helped, like, on your journey of overcoming that, have brought you freedom from that shame?
Brené Brown.
Her
quotes or books, the concept of vulnerability, and that when you share with people who've earned the right to share first, we don't typically share any stories on our blog or with people like this that we haven't processed with each other or journaled or, you know, processed with someone. But I do think it's that vulnerability of sharing our stories, of being seen, that has definitely helped with the shame. And it, but it doesn't mean that it doesn't come up. There's this term that a good friend taught me, sudden temporary upsurge of grief. I feel like it can be applied to shame too, where maybe you're missing someone or you've had a loss due to, I don't know, a divorce or family's changing or anything, and you're feeling like, I've accepted this, I'm doing fine, and then all of a sudden there's something, there's a song, there's something that like hits you, and you have this like upsurge of emotion,
oh my
anger
God,
or something. So
what was that? What, stug?
A stug.
Say that again, because I want everybody to hear
sudden,
that.
A sudden temporary upsurge of grief.
Oh, man. Wow. That's absolutely, that's so good. I mean, yeah, I think we think we've done the work. And a lot of times we have done the work. It's not that we haven't done the work, right? It's that there's many layers of work to do, and there's things that happen in life that trigger us or that catch our attention or that, like, whatever, right? That's, wow, sudden temporary upsurge of grief. Wow.
Even recently for me, I had a newer client I started seeing last week who was referred to me for adjustment to vision loss, who's 19. And when we were when we were developing the treatment plan and going over their goals for counseling, I had this like surge of shame following, because I was like, so many of their goals are still goals of mine. But what's been really like healing and helpful, my own therapist that I go to, is just an amazing human being who's from an Indigenous culture. And they have shared with me that in their culture, the communities they come from, that there's not sort of the same dynamic that we have in our Western culture in terms of like, I am the one helping you and you are the one being helped. There's this real openness of the healer in the community is openly doing their own healing work. Really feel like having conversations like this and being more open and vulnerable requires just so much presence and really helps to address shame. And it's something that we'll just keep revisiting again and again.
I'm thinking of Richard Rohr's quote that we've all heard many times: if you don't transform your pain, you will transmit your pain. I think you could probably say the same thing about shame in a lot of ways, right? And I think what's encouraging to me right now as I'm listening to you guys talk is that, you know, you still have struggles. You still have those moments that you have to combat shame or combat whatever it might be. You haven't arrived. And Janelle, you
are a therapist and you go to a therapist? Whoa, what does that say to everybody, right? Like, come on, right? I think it's like, if I could like mandate that every human being go to therapy, I would do it in a heartbeat, because it has been one of the most important decisions in my life. And here, this is what you do. And you recognize though, that you also need healing day, and that you need, you know, well, I can't, yeah, just as a therapist, everybody needs a therapist if you're a therapist, for sure, because you're taking in so much, right?
For sure.
If you're doing this work, you've got to be doing this work. Oh my gosh.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. I'm curious, let's just kind of bring this down to the person who's watching or listening. I mean, I'm curious, what advice would you give to someone who has, on one hand, creative ideas, whatever that might be, either as an artist or just creative in their work or whatever it might be, but also just feels afraid to throw themselves out there. Mm. And they're afraid to be vulnerable. Maybe it's shame, maybe it's fear, maybe it's all kinds of things. I'm curious what advice you would give on using creativity as a tool for resilience and adaptation. Seems like you guys have done that. So I'm sure not perfectly, but beautifully. And I mean, I read what you guys write. You're both such great writers, by the way. And when I read your blog, it touches me. Like I'm not vision impaired, but there are lessons in it. Like your fears and your, oh man, I find myself going, oh yeah, me too. Me too. So I'm curious, what advice do you guys have for those who have something to bring into this world, but are afraid?
We're both looking at each other like, you go first. I think this is an area where I'm feeling some imposter syndrome coming up, because even though the blog was my idea 12 years ago, Joy has done the bulk of the writing. I have done a lot of writing as well, but in recent years, Joy has always been a very gifted writer. It's been more a passion of hers. And so I feel like she kind of takes the lead on that. And writing takes a lot of time. And I think any creative process, right? And in our culture, we have these pretty limited beliefs around time sometimes. And so, and limited availability because of all the expectations that we have. But so I guess what I would encourage people is, like, whatever creative process, recognize that it is a process, and that even though Joy and I've talked about moving towards more of the vlog or the podcast that's really popular right now, there's a part of slowing down in life and in writing that allows us to process in a different way.
So true. Yes.
And well, I mean, I was just going to say, I wanted to reframe slightly what Janelle was saying for both the listeners and for you and for all of us. In that creativity, you know, notice how she's like, well, she's been the one doing the bulk of the writing. And here I'm thinking, yes. And when you are meeting with your clients, you are putting language to their experiences, listening to them. There's an art in therapy. There's an art in a creativity. Yes. I mean, gosh, you've told me sometimes about all the sudden meditations that you make up on the spot for your clients. Like, that is some creativity. And so I think for the person listening out there, you know, find your art, your form, what works for you, what flows out of you really naturally. It shouldn't be something that feels really hard. It should be something that, yes, it takes sometimes slowing down. It's a process. And it should be something that feels pretty natural to you, whatever that is.
I appreciate that reframe.
Well, she's right. And it's obvious you guys, you bring that art. And it is an art. I mean, just, gosh, I mean, being able to be present enough in the moment to know, okay, what's needed right now is for us to stop talking and to just sit and to be quiet or to meditate or whatever it might be, like to be able to in the moment know that and sense that. You can only do that if you're being present with the person, right? And I think that there's an art to that. There really is. And I think there's an art, so much of what you guys do. I'm imagining, Joy, there was probably moments when you wrote a blog post and maybe you had a few people read it and then you click that button, publish. And I'm guessing there were moments when you're like, oh my God, this is scaring the hell out of me right now to do this. Like it probably felt like jumping off of a cliff, right? I mean, did you have, how do you overcome those moments? You just go for it and do it and be like, all right, throw myself out there.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's because it was something where, for each of the posts that I write that I like, yeah, I do have Ben or someone, Janelle, oftentimes we'll read each other's, we'll help each other with the endings. We'll co-write some. And it does feel like when it's ready to come out, it's just kind of like, you know, kind of like your baby. It's out in the world. Yeah. It's not going back. Then you are just going to be proud of it because it's yours. And yeah, there are some things that, especially from early on the blog, if I look back, I'm like, oh no, what? How did I word that like that? And I would say that my gift, funny enough, is not, I don't think it's the writing itself, the word choice, the how I structure a sentence. Can do some of that, but I feel like it's just putting language to a feeling or to an experience. Mm-hmm. That's where, like, I feel like the goosebumps as I'm writing or whatever, mm-hmm. and then feel like, okay, I want this to go out to people who need to hear it. And you know, sometimes you get, as you guys know, everyone who does creative work, sometimes you get feedback, sometimes you don't, and it feels really good when you do, and you just have to keep moving when you don't. So.
That's great advice right there. Mm-hmm. So true. Mm-hmm. So true.
It's interesting to me, one of the themes in this series that we've talked to all different kinds of creative people and all different kinds of work, from therapy to you know, to mountain biking, to music, to art, is how so much of creativity comes back to becoming willing to let yourself be known. Mm. And the work that you two have done to both, like, the internal work of overcoming the shame and the fear and the guilt and the things that keep us from allowing other people to know us, to see us. And then also the work that you've done to be bold and to share that with others. And then when other people, like you mentioned, like other people with RP or, you know, who are visually impaired are able to read your work and see themselves in it and then share that with others and be like, this is my experience. Or like, you know, like Scott and I, like people who read your story and maybe we're not visually impaired, but we see ourselves in your experience. And I think that is such an important part of creativity as spiritual practice. Is it's not just about like, oh, I made a beautiful thing, or I used a beautiful turn of phrase. Like that's so good and so worthy. But to be able to let ourselves be known,
yeah,
and then
yeah.
to know others, that's such deep and important work. Yeah. And the two of you have just done that with your lives with so much boldness. And I just want to thank you for that work that is such good and difficult and hard work, and the way that you have continued to keep doing it.
Yeah, thank you guys. You've really inspired me. I feel like, Joy, I don't know if you remember this. We were in the car. I was out in Washington or for somewhere we were at, and we were driving, and Ben was there. We were talking about, we just got in this long conversation about your life, and I left that conversation feeling the same way I'm feeling right now, and that is that I think there's some areas in my life creatively that I am being pushed in, but I have fear of like kind of being thrown out there and getting criticized, and you know, and it's like I don't mind the criticism, but it's more like the work involved in having to deal with it sometimes is just like, oh. But like the message I just hear right now is like, is share your life. Don't be afraid. Be authentic to who you are. And it's such an overused word, but I don't know. You guys are pushing me today. Thank you. And I'm sure that a lot of us are feeling that right now. And so thank you for the gift you guys are to this world, to people you don't even know. And thank you for inspiring us today.
Thank you for inviting us. We really appreciate this.
Yeah. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Joy, Janelle. Appreciate you guys.
Hey, Joy, Janelle, thank you guys so very much for that conversation. Let's keep this conversation going. So if you're gathered right now with a couple of people, I want to throw out a couple conversation starters. Or if you're alone, that's fine. Get out a journal, get out a piece of paper. These would be great ideas and thoughts to sort of chew on and to spend a little bit of time on. Here's the first one, all right? This is a great one if you are gathered with a couple of people. I'm curious, what resonated with you the most from today's conversation? You know, was there a particular moment or insight that shifted your perspective or inspired you to perhaps approach life more creatively? So let's start there. What resonated with you the most from today's conversation? Here's the next one. Author Brené Brown. I want to quote her. She once said, vulnerability. This is so good. Listen, vulnerability is not winning or losing. It's having the courage to show up and be seen when we have no control over the outcome. Sit with that for just a moment. Vulnerability is not winning or losing. It's having the courage to show up and be seen when we have no control over the outcome. Definitely a big part of Joy and Janelle's story. And so I'm curious with you, how does this idea connect to your own experiences of being misunderstood as a child or as a young adult? And the second part of that is, how have you or have you had to show up and be vulnerable to change that narrative? How does this idea, you know, I immediately go to when I was a kid in school. School was really hard for me. I had, you know, serious ADHD, and there really wasn't much going on for people with ADHD when I was in, especially when I was in elementary school and even high school. I felt very misunderstood. I had some thoughts come to my mind as we were having this conversation. I'm curious, how does this idea connect to your own experiences of being misunderstood as a child or young adult? And have you had to show up and be vulnerable to change that narrative? And then lastly, in our discussion today, we explored how radically accepting oneself can pave the way to radically accept others and to be more present with others. And so I'm curious, can you think of an area in your life right now where embracing self-acceptance could improve your interactions with the people around you? Can you think of an area in your life where embracing self-acceptance could improve your interactions with the people around you? I hope these conversations, conversation starters actually do that. I hope they start a conversation. At the very least, I hope they lead you into some really transformative self-reflection. Joy and Janelle, thank you again. So good to have you with us, as always. And now, friends, I'm going to turn it over to Anna Hammond.
Friends, it is so good to be with you. Before we depart, I have a couple things to tell you. The first is that next week on September 10th, we would love to be with you in person if you are in the Aurora, Illinois area. We will be gathering at Society 57 for our second Sunday gathering. And this month, we're going to do an extra special, little bit different gathering. I'm so excited. I don't even have words. Our very own Benjamin J. Thomas is going to be in town, and he is going to lead us in a guided concert based off of his new album, Mantra Songs for Starting Over. And if you've been around for a length of time, you'll know these songs, friends. We have sung these songs as part of our gatherings, but Benjamin has put them all together into this new album. And he's going to lead us through a guided concert experience. So it's going to be a little different. It's not going to follow the rhythm of a typical church service, but it will be a powerful time for us to connect with one another and to connect with God, to connect with the Spirit. So I'm so excited to see you there. There's information about that on Facebook that you can check in, or you can look in the Orchard Weekly email if you get that for details. The second thing I want to tell you is that The Orchard is a completely independent organization. What that means is that there's no denomination or larger charitable umbrella supporting this work. We are totally supported by individuals to whom The Orchard has made a difference. People who have been impacted by the work of this community and have chosen to financially support it to see it continue. So if you're one of those people who is keeping our proverbial doors open, thank you so much. You are making a difference. And if you would like to give, if you have been impacted and would like to see this work continue, there are three simple ways that you can give. You can give online by going to our website or by using the app, the Orchard app, or you can send a check, which is this piece of paper, I understand, to the P.O. Box, which is like you have to get a stamp to do this. I've never done that. I give through the app, but if you are a paper checks and stamps person, we'll put the address somewhere. Okay. Friends, however you give, whether you give old school or you give online, your gift is making a real difference and helping us to work toward our mission, which is helping people become who they've been created to be. So if that's you, if you're giving or you're considering giving, thank you so much. And now, friends, I'm going to leave you with this benediction, this blessing for you today. Friends, as you step out into the world, as you go from this sacred gathering into your everyday walking around life, may you be instruments of goodness and beauty, instruments of renewal, laboring tirelessly to build the kingdom of heaven here on earth. May you be blessed with a heart full of love, compassion, and a deep desire to make the world a better place with your creativity. In Jesus' name, we